Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. One of the countries in the region that is considered by many as the strangest nation is the DPRK, that's the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Its media scene is unlike that of any other country. It is tightly controlled, and some of the information put out is, well, rather strange. Chris Green is an expert on North Korea. He lived in Seoul for many years and has written extensively about North Korean media. He now joins us next.
In 1997, a former member, high member of the North Korean government, defected to the South, Hwang Jang-yop, quite a famous man. And at that time, I was working at Cambridge University, and I had access to some literature which was about his defection, and it inspired me to seek more information on North Korea. So that really it sort of incited my interest in the country back in the beginning.
Now, just like myself, you've also had an opportunity to go to North Korea. And when people ask me what it's like, the only thing I can think of saying is that it is a very surreal experience.
It is a surreal experience, yes. The first time I went there, I didn't speak much Korean, and I think not speaking any Korean made it more surreal. I would say it became less surreal the following times because I had more of an awareness of what was going on around me. But that doesn't take away all the surreal nature of the place. Obviously, it's spent 60 years diverging from what I would call the norm of states, and the results are there for all to see.
Now, in the last couple of weeks, we've seen a lot of the rhetoric, a lot of the propaganda coming out of North Korea being turned up. Now, I can't think of any other time in history, even during the days of the Cold War with the Soviet Union, using that same kind of propaganda. It just seems that with North Korea, a lot of people are saying right now with what they're doing is just them doing their usual thing, like a spoiled child wanting attention. Would you agree with people that are saying that? Or is there something more serious here?
Fundamentally, I would agree with people saying that, but I think there are other issues that need to be taken into account, such as the new young leader phenomenon, the need for him to assert his strength and dominance over the polity. All of these things do contribute. Of course, there's also the problem that, as you know very well, North Korea has been playing this same game for quite a long time, and as with all games where you don't follow through on your threats, you are subject to the law of diminishing returns, and I think that may be a part of it as well. So there's a coagulation of multiple factors at this point.
Now, Chris, with all the propaganda that we've seen, obviously this is targeting a North Korean public, but it seems that so many people are worried in the West, which seems kind of odd since North Korea has a history of doing this. Why are people so, especially in the West, so concerned about all these really strong statements that are coming out of the North?
In the context of South Korea, at least, I think it's because they have a lot to lose. So it's worth them being concerned by the rhetoric. But equally, people in the US or perhaps in Western Europe, maybe they don't follow North Korea that closely, and they instinctively presume that some of what the North Koreans are saying must be rooted in fact. You have to be watching quite closely to feel unconcerned by the rhetoric that comes from Pyongyang. And of course, that's part of the point, because if nobody cared, which would perhaps be the ideal situation, then there'd be no point doing it.
Just the other day, I was speaking to a professor at Tsinghua University in China. Mm. And he said to me that this is a bit of a dangerous game going on right now, because he said what could happen is, he said, Western governments and even South Korea or even Japan could read this stuff the wrong way. And, you know, it's the kind of situation where, you know, it just takes one shot to be fired to cause a problem.
Yes, there is the risk of miscalculation. I would agree. These games are always dangerous. North Korea has never played the game the safe way. So from that perspective, yes, I think there is value in those words.
Now, with the information that Daily NK is getting out of North Korea, how do they view Kim Jong-un? Do they view him the same way as his father and his grandfather? Or do they look at him with, a little bit more skepticism?
I think they certainly look at him with a certain degree of skepticism, but that's precisely the problem that propaganda wonks in Pyongyang have been working to try and change. We have to understand that the North Korean people, of course, didn't view Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il the same way at all. They viewed Kim Il-sung in an infinitely more preferable light overall. But since Kim Jong-un came to power, there have been periods of attempting to make the public expectant, to raise expectations in them that something is going to happen, that the economic situation is going to improve. But there have also been periods of crackdown, which have made people very cynical. So at the time of writing, I would say that the North Korean people aren't quite sure what to expect, because Kim Jong-un's only been in power for a little bit more than a year. It's not a long time to make value judgments on his rule, is it?
Considering that he's only been there a year and he is so young, do you think that he, like his father, would have the same amount of control? Or are there other people behind the scenes, some generals and some other high-up party officials in the Workers' Party, who are the ones really pulling the strings?
Oh, I think it's absolutely inevitable that there is a committee rule going on at this point. Of course, we all know about Kim Jong-il's sister, Kim Jong-hee. She's clearly an important power broker there. We also know about her husband, Jang Song-taek. I mean, these names are all in the public domain. We don't know exactly the combinations and the power structure, but we do know that they're all working together.
If you had a crystal ball, would you just look at the situation and think that it's all going to blow over? Or how long can they really keep up with this rhetoric? Because now they put the military on standby. They've cut off communications with the South through the hotline. And just today, we saw them turning away South Koreans to the economic zone that they were jointly cooperating with. It's just another step. And that at some point, they're just going to say, you know, everything will just go back to normal. Because I'm wondering here, if they're saying all this stuff, how can they say that they were victorious over something if nothing happens?
That's a very good point. I think they can basically spin any kind of step back on the part of the South Korean government, for example, as a victory. So I don't think that's necessarily a problem. The propaganda people in Pyongyang are extremely resourceful and have been for 60 years. If I had a crystal ball, and alas, I do not, I would suggest that Kim Il-sung's birthday, the anniversary of Kim Il-sung's birthday, is on the 15th of April, and it's not customary to maintain this level of military tension through that type of event. I think they will want to change the game by then. Equally, in 2009, when the North Koreans last threatened the Kaesong Industrial Complex, they did so for about 3 days. Now, as I mentioned earlier, the law of diminishing returns is in effect, so perhaps we might be looking at 4 or 5 days. But I do think that by the 15th, something will have to change. Whether it be temporary or permanent, I don't know. That would depend on the actions of outside actors like the government in Seoul and Washington. But I do think that things will have to loosen up a bit by then.
Now, we've seen a lot of strange things happen with North Korea lately, and I want to talk about South Koreans for a moment. I mean, just a few weeks ago, they saw the former NBA star Dennis Rodman at a basketball match in Pyongyang with Kim Jong-un. And then, of course, Dennis Rodman is making some statements. He's my friend and all these other things. And now they're seeing this. How do South Koreans see this?
South Koreans are quite sanguine, aren't they? I mean, they've seen this for a long time. Of course, we should remember that the level of North Korea coverage in South Korean newspapers is infinitely higher than in the West, and it covers a broader range of subjects. So I would say that the standard of knowledge of North Korea among South Koreans is instinctively much higher than it is in the West. So yes, as I say, they're more relaxed than perhaps a lot of people in Western countries would be.
One of the fears that some people are having right now, especially if we take, say, China, which is North Korea's closest ally. We've seen the Chinese now getting sort of, you know, enough is enough kind of attitude, beginning to take a stronger issue. A lot of people are saying that China is key to dealing with North Korea. Do you see China as being key to dealing with North Korea?
Yes, I would say that China is probably key to dealing with North Korea. But there's two things to say about that as well. The Chinese have two options. They can keep North Korea going, or they can close it down, probably. But there isn't too much nuance in that, is there? Right? You're either providing them with oil or you're not. Mm-hmm. You know. So from that perspective, their range of action is probably more circumscribed than a lot of people would give it credit for. On the flip side as well, we've noticed that although there has been definitely a relaxation of the scale of things that can be said about North Korea in the Chinese media. You can criticize them more now than you probably could 5 years ago if you're a Chinese journalist. But on the other hand, there was one Chinese journalist who wrote a piece for the Financial Times that appears to have overstepped the line, and we heard in just the last few days that he's been removed from his post. So perhaps that was an indication that there is a line in the sand over which journalists should not tread, and perhaps we are asking too much to imagine that the Chinese are going to abandon North Korea at this point in time.
Some people have been suggesting that probably one of the best ways to put all this to rest would be for the U.S. to call North Korea and say, look, we want to talk directly to you. But it just seems that the U.S. is, at this time anyway, is unwilling to do that. They want to go back to the six-party talks, which haven't really been that successful. Do you think that Washington should just go directly to North Korea and say, look, we want to talk to you directly and just resolve all these issues?
I don't think it's a good idea to do that at this time, because that just plays into the game that is being played by North Korea. You can't wait for them to raise military tensions to unprecedented heights and then say, okay, we're going to talk to you. That's exactly what they want to happen. Mm-hmm. So no, I wouldn't advocate that course of action at this point in time.
With the South Koreans, I mean, now we have a new president in South Korea. She must be in a bit of an odd situation right now, because she when she was running for president, she said, you know, she wanted to have better dialogue with North Korea.
Yes, but that was a forlorn hope, wasn't it? And I think she was mostly appealing to the South Korean voters, who had grown tired of the former president Lee Myung-bak's hardline conservative stance. The South Korean voters' opinion is broadly speaking based on whether they are instinctively progressive or conservative. As far as I can tell, it doesn't really have too much to do with their appraisal, objective appraisal of North Korea's actions. Mm-hmm. So Park Geun-hye, the new president, was actually just appealing to the voter base in an attempt to make sure that she kept her vote together, which she obviously did very well. So from that perspective, she was highly successful, and it doesn't really matter what the outcome was because she's now in power.
How much of North Korea as a topic plays into South Korean politics? Is it one of the main issues?
When compared with things like welfare and all the things that concern the middle and low-income families of the world, then no, it's probably not a major issue, but it is one of the major issues on which people can stake their claim to be different. If you're a progressive thinker, a left-wing thinker, then you have a certain perspective on North Korea, and if you're a conservative, you have a different perspective. But you might not necessarily have a different perspective on less polarizing issues. So it's a way for people to distinguish themselves.
The thing that I've always found amazing about the things that North Korea says, especially their propaganda, either from television or their radio broadcast in English and other languages, I wonder sometimes, do they really think that people in the West don't look at this and look at this and go, oh, we understand what they mean? Or do they think, oh, people are looking at this and laughing at us?
I think to an extent they expect people to look at it and find it strange. I think North Korea is very well aware that how it is regarded in the international community, and it seeks to foster the right impression, because North Korea obviously has huge human rights problems, is a heavily militarized society, etc., etc., and so on. And yet in the West, Dennis Rodman maybe makes bigger headlines. Now, is that not a propaganda success for the North Korean regime? I would argue that it is.
Mm-hmm. It's just, when I've seen some of the, just recently I was watching a documentary that was from North Korean television that was dubbed into English. And it was about not Kim Jong-un's father, Kim Sung.
Kim Il-sung, yes.
Kim Il-sung. And it was the strangest thing, because he was an expert in every field imaginable. And it was obviously produced for an overseas audience. And I'm thinking, you know, if people in their propaganda department really think that an overseas audience would go, oh, yeah, he's obviously an intelligent man. He's an expert film director. He's an expert architect. And the strangest line in there was from, because it was a pretty old documentary, was that He's a champion. I still remember the line. He's a champion Olympic swimmer, but because of his duties at home, he could not partake in the Olympic Games. And I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute. How can they say this and think that people will believe them?
Well, I'm not sure they do say them and expect people to believe them. As I say, I think the North Korean propaganda people, I mean, to an extent, they just can't avoid saying those things because these things attain a certain currency. And much like not wanting to be the first person to stop clapping in front of Stalin back in the day, people have to be careful that they keep up with the Joneses on making these statements. They continue to be stated far longer than they have any right to be. But that being said, I don't think too many people actually believe the more extreme one.
Journalist Chris Green, who's covered the DPRK, that's the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, a number of times. You're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. I should remind you that next week's program will be back to our usual fare, as we're currently on vacation right now. Well, since we are on vacation, we're going to talk a little bit about traveling. Asian travelers, especially over the last few years, have been very interested in cruise ships. There's a number of cruise ships, of course, that travel around Asia and the Pacific, as well as those that travel around Europe, as well as the Caribbean and North America. The Chinese are expected to be the number one group that take part in these cruises. Somebody who's been involved in the cruise ship industry for a number of years and, well, partakes in a number of them is Jeff White. He now joins us next. Jeff, as you know, cruising the seven seas, as some people might say, it was a very popular activity. And especially over the last few years, you're seeing a lot more travelers from let's say, China that are taking up cruises in Europe and the Caribbean. And there's a lot of people, of course, that still ask questions about it because they don't really know what to expect and stuff like that. What are some of the real popular cruises, let's say like in the Western Hemisphere?
Well, the biggest cruise port, of course, is Miami, followed closely by Fort Lauderdale, which is only 45 minutes away. Mm-hmm. Those are the two biggest cruise ports. And from there, most of the cruises are going, of course, right to the Bahamas, which is very close. Those are shorter cruises of maybe 2, 3, 4 days. And then you have one-week cruises, perhaps, or sometimes less than a week. They go to some of the other Caribbean islands. Usually you'll do the Western Caribbean route, which will go to the Mexico, Cozumel, and so on, and the Cayman Islands and Jamaica. And then there's the Eastern Caribbean route, which will go down to some of the islands, Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands, and so on. And then some of the longer cruises will go even further down towards the Aruba, Bonaire, Curacao, and even to South America. And then you have some longer cruises that will go into the Caribbean to like Cartagena, Colombia, and to Panama. And then some of them go into the Panama Canal, or some of them even, you know, cross the Panama Canal to the Pacific Ocean.
Now, with these cruises, you said the two largest ports are Fort Lauderdale and Miami. Does that mean that the majority of the cruises, these are the ports? For example, if somebody from China was to take a cruise in the Caribbean, they would have to fly to Florida first?
Yes. There are a few that leave from other places. There are some that leave from other ports in Florida, Jacksonville or Tampa on the West Coast. There are a few that leave from San Juan, Puerto Rico. And there are some that leave from during certain seasons from Galveston, Texas, or from the northeastern U.S., from New York, for example. But for the most variety of cruises available, yeah, it's pretty much South Florida, Miami and Fort Lauderdale.
Now, with these cruises, you mentioned, you know, sometimes maybe you'll go to Bahamas, just a very short trip, or maybe you'll visit like sometimes 3, 4, or maybe even 5 different countries. How does the visa thing work out? Does that mean, for example, if anybody in the world goes on these, they have to get 5 different visas?
Sometimes there are visa issues, but in the Caribbean, there's really no problem. As long as you have a visa to get into the U.S. so that you can take the cruise, you're in pretty good shape because most of these islands don't require visas or they have special arrangements with the cruise lines for people who are just you know, stopping in a port for several hours to take an excursion or something like that. Occasionally, certain nationalities may have problems, but visas are not a big problem in most of the Caribbean islands and Central America. Most of the cruises leaving from Florida.
See, the reason I asked that, because I was very surprised to find out. I mean, here in Taiwan, we have a port, which is Geelong, which is the largest port in Taiwan. And a few times a year, we have cruise ships maybe that were doing a trip of the Pacific coming up to East Asia, and they'll stop here in Taiwan for a day or sometimes 2 days. And I was surprised to find out that when people leave the ship to go inland, come to Taipei, they don't even have a passport control.
That's right. Most of them don't. There are special arrangements for these cruise ships. I went to the Bahamas the other day to Nassau, and they did actually check our passports very briefly, but no stamping and asking questions and that sort of thing. Because you can imagine, some of these cruise ships have 4,000 or 5,000 passengers, and you get all these people unloading in a particular port. They're only going to be there for maybe 5, 6 hours or 7 hours, and they do not want to hold these people up at the with immigration and that sort of thing. They have to, they want them to get out and spend money in the stores and take their excursions, go to the beaches or whatever.
So it's a lot. It's probably a better way to say travel around the Caribbean instead of taking small hopper flights where you have to fly through airports.
And actually, cruising is a very good way of traveling through Europe these days as well, because essentially, you're on the ship, you only have to pack and unpack one time, and you go from port to port, traveling usually at nighttime. And then spending your time during the day at these places, and it's a one price includes all, most things anyway, all of your food and that sort of thing. The excursions cost extra, but you can do a lot of countries in a relatively small amount of time this way. Of course, you're only getting a glance at each one. You're only getting 1 day or less than 1 day in each port in most cases. But if you want to see a lot of places in a fairly short amount of time for a quite reasonable price, it's a good way of doing it.
And on the cruise ships themselves, I mean, because there's, very often so many different nationalities, does that mean, for example, service is also available in these different languages?
Well, you might be surprised, but most of the cruise ships over in this part of the world, the crew comes from your part of the world. They are from the Philippines, Indonesia, Malaysia, all over. Actually, there are some from quite a few now from Eastern Europe as well. But most of them are Asian, I would say. And so, and they all speak English, of course. Now, the announcements that they make, it depends on the particular cruise line, and they will vary this depending on the clientele that happened to be on the ship at the time. Some of them will do all their announcements in English. Usually there will be two or three languages. Costa is one company that does them like 5 languages. And there's always people who speak multiple languages among the crew. And they'll have special booths or offices where people can go to visit people who speak their language if they need particular help or orientation on the ship.
And what are some of the most popular cruises that people can take? I mean, we mentioned, I would suspect the ones in the Western Hemisphere and around the Caribbean are extremely popular, and Europe as well. What about other regions?
Well, Alaska, of course, is very popular. Most of those cruises leave from Seattle, Washington, or from Vancouver, close to Seattle there in Canada, and they'll go up to various ports in Alaska and sometimes combine them with excursions further into Alaska to Mount McKinley and Anchorage, Fairbanks and places like that. So that's very popular. Hawaii has quite a few cruises, covering 4 or 5 islands in a week. There are a lot of 1 week cruises there, and there are a lot of cruises that leave Hawaii and go down to the South Pacific that are longer cruises. So, I mean, some of them go on for 30 days. But
30 days.
Yeah, some of them. There are around the world cruises, Keith.
Really?
Where you can just, in fact, there's one, I forget what it's called now, that you can actually live on the ship, and you just travel constantly around the world. It takes, 2 or 3 months or whatever to go around the world, but they just do that continuously. There's a lot of, and of course, there are more and more ports, more and more areas that are being developed for cruising as people, because there are a lot of repeat cruises. People who take cruises tend to repeat again and again and again, and they always want to go to new places. So now they're developing places like, the western coast, the fjords of Norway have been popular for quite some time. Now they're developing cruises to Greenland, for example. And of course, there are a few that go to Antarctica. Leaving from southern South America, or I think from New Zealand, and so there's a lot of adventure to be found. And the Middle East is also an area that's opening up. A lot of cruises now leave from Dubai, traveling to around that part of the world, and into India and so on. And Asia is a very developing area now. You mentioned the Chinese cruisers. I was at a conference here in Miami, Cruise Shipping Miami, which is the biggest industry event every year, a few weeks ago. And they were saying that there was a presentation by the Hong Kong Tourist Board. They did a survey, and they were finding that they said that about 2 out of every 10 cruisers in the world now is Chinese. But within the next 5 to 10 years, they expect that to be as much as 8 out of 10. So the Chinese are really they seem to like cruising, and they're cruising around Asia, of course. A lot of cruises leave from Hong Kong and then go to Taiwan, and then from Taiwan, sometimes they'll take the north route up to Japan and Korea, and sometimes they'll take the southern route down to the Philippines. But more and more cruises are being developed in Asia, and of course Australia and New Zealand and the Pacific as well. But a lot of these Chinese tourists, of course, cruisers are coming over here to the U.S. and taking tours, cruises in the Caribbean and South America and so on.
And that was my conversation with Jeff White on cruise ships and the Asian tourists that partake in them. And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you'd like to contact us to let us know what you think of the program and have any story ideas, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. Next week, we're going to be getting back to our, regular program. So we hope to see you then. On behalf of the whole team here at PCJ Radio International, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, and take care.